Please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Smart. Elizabeth was just 14 years old when she was taken from her home by knife point. She was held captive for 9 months, and now she has dedicated her life to help other victims of abuse. Welcome, Elizabeth Smart.
Hello, everyone. I am thrilled to be with you this morning. I feel so lucky to be able to communicate with you somehow, even if it can't be in person. You know, as I have traveled and as I have presented all over the country, there's a few things that I've come to learn that honestly are actually incredibly special to me. And it took me a while to learn them. It took me a while, even longer probably, to articulate them. But I'd like to share them with you today because I believe them. I think they're true. I think they're true for each one of us. The first thing that I really truly believe that I feel like is so important that everyone should know is that there is nothing more resilient than the human spirit. I mean, as I mentioned, as I've gone out and even just in my day-to-day life, I mean, when I run to the grocery store or I'm at the park with my kids, there is rarely a time that I go out and I don't have someone come and approach me. And usually it's someone sharing their story with me, saying something like, my story is similar to yours. When I was a kid, I was raped. My story is similar to yours. When I was a kid, I was kidnapped. I lived through domestic violence. I watched this happen. I mean, it's a rare day, frankly, that I don't have someone come and disclose their story to me. But as I've seen that, and as I watch these people, I am amazed at how resilient they are. Yes, not perfect. I'm not perfect. Good heavens. But resilient in that they keep going. They keep moving forward. They keep trying. They never give up. And that's incredible. That's amazing. The second thing that I feel like I've learned since I've been on this journey is that no one else can take away your worth, that we were all born with this incredible worth, with this incredible value. I mean, I hesitate to even use the words like worth and value because it's like placing a price on someone, and I don't think you can do that. I mean, I think each one of us carries an infinite worth within us, and no one else can take that from you. No one else can diminish that. No one else can ruin that. You will always have that with you. And the third thing that I really truly believe, that took me honestly a very long time to accept and understand and allow it into my life, is that every single one of us, first of all, has a story. Every single one of us has had something that's happened to us. I mean, hopefully not everyone. It's kidnapping and captivity and raping. But regardless and nonetheless, we all have a story. Maybe it's dealing with a family illness. Maybe it's losing the loss of a loved one. Maybe it's losing a job. Maybe it's financial, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. We all have a story. We all have had something difficult happen to us in our life. And it's not so much those difficult, hard things that we don't have any control over that happen to us, that define us. Really, what ultimately defines us are the choices that we make, the actions that we take in response to what happens. I mean, I lived for years with feeling like I would always be known as the girl that was kidnapped. I would always be known as that girl from Utah who was kidnapped and was found. And I mean, as I mentioned, for years, that's what I believed. That's what I felt. And I remember having this thought one day that I did not, like, if I died tomorrow, I mean, heaven forbid, but if I died tomorrow and my funeral was in a few days from now, I remember thinking, I don't want the only thing to be said at my funeral was talking about how I survived a kidnapping. That's honestly, I don't even want that mentioned. I want people to talk about me, and I want people to talk about what I was like and you know, the good things that I did in this world or tried to do, or, you know, those kinds of things, funny stories. I mean, sorry, off topic, but my grandma died about a year ago. And, I mean, I was very sad when she died, but at her funeral, I laughed as much as I cried, which was saying something, because it was waterfalls falling down my face. And as I think about it, I mean, that's what I would want my funeral to be. You know, I'd want people to have a good laugh at it. Anyway, I know I'm getting so off topic, so I'm coming back. But ultimately, it is these decisions that define us. It's what we decide to do next. Do we surrender to the hard times in our life? Do we decide to keep going? Do we decide to keep trying? Do we look outside ourselves for help? Maybe for a mentor, for a therapist, for some guidance? I mean, ultimately, what we decide is what defines who we are. And these three things, realizing that, you know, the human spirit is so resilient, realizing that no one else can devalue me, can take away my worth, and ultimately I'm not defined by my kidnapping. Those three things really have helped shape me into who I am today. Because going back before I was kidnapped, I grew up in, well, you could pretty much call it a bubble. I lived a very sheltered life. I was second of six kids. I never thought anything bad could happen to us. I mean, sure, we might get a cold. Sure, like, you know, I don't know, my bike tire might go flat, or I might not do well on an assignment. Or, you know, maybe I procrastinated cleaning my room one too many times, so my parents got upset with me. But those were like the things that in my mind as a kid were bad. Like, as far as actual crimes being committed against me went, I never dreamt that that could even be a remote possibility. And I remember, I mean, there's some things that I just remember so vividly. There are some things I genuinely can't remember hardly at all. Like if you ask me what I had for lunch yesterday, that's a struggle. But I remember very clearly the feelings that I felt as I was approaching the end of my junior high experience. And they were all very positive emotions, because I guess I can't speak for anyone else but myself. But man, if there is an awkward time in someone's life, I'm going to put forward that it has to be junior high. I mean, is there a more awkward time? I don't think so. I mean, puberty, let's just call it what it is. It's not nice. And I remember thinking that once I got to high school, all of the awkwardness, all of the struggle, all of the insecurities that come along with puberty would disappear. And I was so excited for that. I was excited to try to figure out my own schedule, be able to sign up for classes that I wanted to be involved in, maybe try out for the track team or the cross country team. Maybe, I don't know, be able to go to a high school dance or be asked by a boy to a high school dance. I mean, that was pretty exciting to me. What I'm saying is I was excited for a lot of the different elements and aspects that make up high school. I was very excited to leave junior high in the past, because junior high was just awkward. That's all there is to it. And I remember it was the day before I was about to graduate. And it started off just like any other day. There really wasn't anything about it that stood out. There wasn't really anything about it that made it any different from any other day. I remember going through the motions. I remember just being really excited for summer, for sleeping in, for homework. And I remember that night, my parents called us all in for our evening family prayer. And so I remember kneeling down, praying together. I remember getting up, and then I kind of hesitated in my parents' room for a few minutes because I wanted to beg them some more, because my best friend had asked me to go on a vacation with her. And I was so excited about it. I could not wait to go. I really, really, really wanted to go. And my parents, they'd already said no. And typically they didn't change their mind, but I really wanted to go. So I was going to pester them just a little bit longer in hopes that they would change their mind. And so all my siblings, they left and I stayed in there. I just begged and begged and begged and frankly annoyed my parents. And they finally said, fine, you can go. And I was so excited. I remember just skipping out of their room. But my big brother was standing outside the door and he just looked at me. He was like, Elizabeth, are you crazy? What is wrong with you? Did I hear? Surely I did not hear you correctly. There's no way that I heard you correctly. But did you just ask Mom if you could go on vacation with your friend to Beaver, Utah? Now, I'm guessing that probably most of you have never heard of Beaver, Utah. But I'm willing to bet there's probably a few of you that are like, yeah, I know where that is. Or, yeah, I'm from there. Or, yeah, like, I have family that lives there. Something along those lines, because it always happens. No matter how small I thought Beaver was, there's always someone in the audience who's been there. So please do not take offense. I'm sure it's amazing. But my big brother, at the time, he did not think so. And so he's like, Elizabeth, why on earth are you going to Beaver, Utah? I mean, what is wrong with you? Like, you're crazy. What are you going to do? You're going there for a week? I mean, what are you going to be doing sitting at the gas station for a week, Elizabeth? That's all there is there. That's what you're going to be doing. Now, just once again, keep in mind, this was like 18, 19, basically two decades ago. So it was less than it is today. Anyway, he kept on teasing me the way big brothers do. And I remember looking at him and just saying, well, Charles, you know, at the very least, I will be away from you. And he's just like, oh, Elizabeth, even I'm not that bad. And then he kept on teasing me for a while. And I turned around to walk into my room and I stopped one last time. And I looked at him one last time and I said, well, Charles, what if those were the last words you ever say to me? And he just kind of looked at me and he kind of smiled. And then he turned around and walked away. And I remember turning around and walking into my bedroom. And I shared a room with my younger sister, Mary Catherine. I actually shared a bed with her. We slept in the same bed. And I remember finishing getting ready for bed and going into where the actual room was, and crawling into bed next to my sister and going to sleep. And that was pretty much the day leading up to my kidnapping. I mean, there wasn't anything strange about it. There wasn't anything abnormal about it. There wasn't anything, I don't know. I didn't have any feelings of foreboding. In fact, when I went to bed and I was incredibly happy. I mean, I was very excited about the future. I was very much looking forward to the summer, to everything that lay ahead of me. So, I mean, I wasn't scared going to sleep. I wasn't nervous. It was just another day. But the next thing I remember hearing was this man's voice. And when I first heard this man's voice, I remember thinking that, wait a second, this can't be real. There's no way that this can be real. I mean, there's a man in my bedroom. That's like, that's just not possible. Men aren't allowed in my bedroom. And only my dad, and he wouldn't be in here in the middle of the night. Like this must just be part of my dream. This must just be part of my imagination, because there's no way this can be real. And so I laid there, and then I heard the voice again, repeating the same words again, saying, I have a knife at your neck. Don't make a sound. Get up and come with me. And when I heard that voice the second time, I remember feeling something cold and sharp lying across my neck. I remember feeling someone's hand on my arm trying to pull me out of bed. I remember feeling terrified. I mean, nothing in my life had prepared me for that moment. I mean, like I mentioned at the beginning, I never thought anything bad could happen to me. I didn't think anything bad could happen to my family. And all of a sudden, there was this stranger in my bedroom telling me to get up and to go with him. And he had a knife at my neck. And I didn't know what to do. I felt like the only thing I could do was go with him. Because of all the safety education that I had been given up until that point in my life, which, you know, I was 14, like, I felt like I'd been pretty well prepared. I mean, you know, I knew what to do if I caught on fire, should stop, drop, and roll. If there was an earthquake, that I should go stand in a doorway or get under a table. Don't stand under a tree in a lightning storm. You know, be careful with knives. Don't talk to strangers. Don't go looking for a lost puppy, and don't take candy from people you don't know. Which, while we're on the topic, just briefly, I mean, has anyone actually ever thought about that? Don't take candy from people you don't know. What bad advice. Like, I'm not saying you should take candy from people you don't know, but we've got a whole holiday celebrating taking candy from people we don't know. I mean, I don't know what more what a bigger contradiction we could tell our kids than don't take candy from people you don't know, and then turn around and be like, okay, trick or treating now. Anyway, sorry. It's really easy for me to go down rabbit holes, especially when it's things that I feel passionate about. So all of this safety information, safety education that I'd been given throughout my life ran through my head, but none of it seemed to apply to that moment. I mean, I couldn't just stop, drop, and roll while the guy was holding a knife at my neck telling me to get up and go with him. I mean, fat lot of good that would have done. Plus, he was bigger than me. He was stronger than me. Like, he was pulling me out of bed. And so I felt like the best thing to do was to get up and go with him, because what if I struggled? Would he just kill me? Would he kill my younger sister who was in bed next to me? What would he do to her? And I remember just frankly being terrified. And so I remember getting up. He led me into my closet. I remember going to reach for a pair of slippers because he told me to grab shoes, and my slippers were right there and they were easy to put on. But he specifically said, no, not those. And he pointed to a pair of tennis shoes and he told me to get them. So I did. And then I remember grabbing them, and I remember I went to put them on, but he was like, no, not in here. And so then he led me through my house. And just for like a frame of reference, my bedroom, it was not located on the ground floor. In fact, it was probably one of the highest points of our entire house. I mean, it was high off the ground. Even if you stood a ladder up next to the house, I don't think the ladder would have even reached our window. I mean, it was very high up in the air. And I remember he led me down through the middle of my home, down the stairs, in through the kitchen. I mean, we passed right through the heart of the house. We went down a flight of stairs. Like, it wasn't just a quick jump out the window. And then I remember we approached the back kitchen door, which I was feeling, well, obviously I was feeling scared, but I also had this feeling of relief, because on all the doors in our house, my parents had an alarm system on. So whenever you opened a door, a beeping sound would go off. And I remember we approached the door, and I remember just thinking, the alarm's going to go off. My parents are going to wake up, and this is all going to be over. Well, he opened the door, and the alarm did not go off. I remember just being so panicked, thinking, how did this happen? Why did this happen? Why didn't the alarm go off? It should have gone off. Like, did he do something? Turns out it was just bad luck. The magnet that set in the frame that causes the alarm to go off had actually fallen out. So it was just bad luck. Anyway, he led me up through my backyard, and the neighborhood, the home that I grew up in, was part of a neighborhood that sat up on one of the mountainsides overlooking the Salt Lake Valley. And so the front of my house overlooked the valley, and the back of my house, of course, there's our backyard, but then I mean, there was like a vacant lot. There was one more street that had some houses, but they weren't like tightly packed close to each other. They were kind of spread out. And just after that last street, it was just mountains after that. I mean, the neighborhood ended. There was nothing behind there, just wilderness, if you will. And honestly, I played a ton behind my house growing up as a kid. I mean, my dad took us hiking up behind our house. I mean, I think I was very familiar with the area. And I remember getting up through my backyard. We were at the top of my backyard, kind of where my backyard meets the vacant lot. And that's when he instructed me to sit down, to put my shoes on, and I did. And then he had me get up again, and he had me starting to go through this vacant lot. And he still had his knife on me, he's still holding on to me. And right when you get up to the road, there's a couple of bushes. And he pushed me down behind some bushes. And I remember wondering, what's going to happen here? What's going on? And I couldn't really lift my head that high because he was holding me down. But I remember I was able to lift it just enough that I could see the street. I mean, not over the top of the bushes, but kind of through the bushes. And I remember seeing some headlights coming towards us, which I immediately started thinking, well, this is the getaway car. I mean, he must have this all planned out. This is, wow, like I didn't think it was possible for anything like this to happen to me. But he really does have this all planned out. He really did plan on kidnapping me. He really did plan on taking me. And I remember this car getting closer and closer and closer, and it passed right in front of me. And I remember for the half a second that it was in front of me, I remember seeing the word police written on the side of the car. And I remember for that half a second, I remember feeling so relieved once again, feeling like, oh, nothing that bad can happen to me because the police are here and they're going to rescue me. And, you know, their job is to protect me, their job is to save me. So this is going to be over. Like, nothing bad's going to happen to me. But the police car didn't stop. It kept going. And pretty soon it was around the bend from us. And as soon as it was around the bend from where we were at, there was this man grabbing hold of me, pulling me up off the ground, and having me run across the street as fast as I could. The other side of the street, I mean, there were just, like, as I mentioned, there were houses, but they were spread out. And there was actually a trailhead that was across the street from where this bush was. And so he first initially had me start running up this trail. And I mean, you're almost immediately out of sight once you get just even a few feet into this trail. And he had me starting going up this trail, but there's a point in the trail where you're going up this small canyon ravine kind of thing, and you go up one side, but you don't go very far deep into it. I mean, you stay pretty close to the mouth of this canyon ravine, and you cross over, and then you come down the other side and you keep going. Well, I got to the point in the trail where you're crossing over from one side to the other. And instead of continuing on down the other side of this trail, this man pushed me off of the trail and he told me to keep heading up this ravine. And so I did. And initially it wasn't too difficult, but it got harder and harder and harder. And eventually it was so difficult to move through all this brush. I had to get down on my hands and knees and crawl because it just was too hard. And I remember it time it seemed on one hand it seemed to be speeding forward, on the other hand it seemed to be standing still. I remember I didn't know how far we had gone. I didn't feel like it was that far, but at the same time it felt like it was forever. And I remember even at one point stopping and turning to my captor and saying, well, if you're going to rape and kill me, could you please do it here? It was important for me that my parents knew what happened to me, that they knew what happened to my body, that they knew that this wasn't me being a rebellious teenager. Not that I thought necessarily that they would think that, because I just wasn't a rebellious kid, really, at all. And yeah, I just wanted them to have some kind of closure over what had happened. But when I said that to me, you know, if you're just going to rape and kill me, could you please do it here? He looked at me and he kind of got this smile on his face and he's like, oh, I'm not going to rape and kill you yet. And we kept on going. And it felt like, once again, it felt like we went on forever and ever and ever. And then I stopped him again. And I said, don't you realize what you're doing? I mean, if you get caught, you'll spend the rest of your life in prison. But if you let me go, it'll be like this never happened. Just please, please let me go. And he looked at me again and he smiled again and said, oh, I know exactly what I'm doing. The only difference is, well, I'm not going to get caught. And we kept going, we kept going, we kept going. And finally we crossed right over the top of the mountain, which was a long ways, but I don't know, time and distance, they both just seem to, I don't know. I can't describe it in that moment. But when we started down the other side of the mountain, we came to the stand of trees, which wasn't that strange. I mean, we fought our way up through trees. I mean, why wouldn't it be normal to have trees on the other side? And from the outside, the stand of trees, they looked just like all the others. There was nothing about it that stood out. There was nothing about it that, there's just nothing special about it. But I remember he had directed me to walk into the stand of trees, so I did. And I remember once I got to the middle, I saw how part of the mountainside had been leveled out. And then there was a tent set up. And outside of the tent, there were some tarps lying on the ground. And there were some tarps hanging up in the trees. And I remember all of a sudden seeing this woman appear. And when I saw her, I was almost immediately relieved. Because if there was a woman there, surely nothing that bad could happen to me. And I think in an effort to protect myself, my brain started going to all of the places or all of the reasons or excuses as to why they could possibly kidnap me in the most innocent way. Like, for example, when I saw the woman, I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe they kidnapped me because they couldn't have children and they wanted children. Or maybe they kidnapped me because they had a daughter and she died. Something bad happened to her and they miss her and they want her back, but they can't have her back, so maybe that's why they kidnapped me. I mean, if there was ever an innocent reason for kidnapping someone, that's what my brain was telling me in that moment. And I wish I could say that that was true, but as soon as this woman, because the first thing she did was hug me, and as soon as she hugged me, I knew that wasn't true. I knew that they didn't kidnap me because they wanted a daughter. I knew that they didn't kidnap me because, you know, they wanted a child. All those very innocent thoughts immediately evaporated. Because when she hugged me, it was like she was trying to tell me that if I ever did anything that she didn't want me to do, if I ever rebelled against her, if I ever crossed her in any way, that I'd be sorry, and that she wanted me to know that she was the boss. I mean, if a hug could convey all that, that's what that hug conveyed. And I remember she led me inside of the tent. I mean, it was like she was hugging me, and then she took her arm around me and she walked inside of the tent. And she sat me down on this upturned bucket, and she'd brought in this small little blue basin, and it had water in it. And she started to take my shoes off. And then she started to try to unbutton my pajamas. And I was very, very shy as a kid. I was very self-conscious. There was just no way that I was ever going to be okay with allowing this woman really anywhere near me. I remember grabbing hold of the buttons on my pajamas. I remember clamping my elbows down next to my torso so that she couldn't pull them off. And I remember she became more and more frustrated. And she finally was like, well, if you don't let me do this, I'm going to have Emmanuel come in here and he's going to rip your pajamas off you. And I remember telling her, well, you know, I'm a big girl. Like, if you want me to change into something, you know, I can do it myself. You don't need to touch me. I'm not dirty. You don't need to sponge bathe me. Cause that's why she had brought in that little basin full of water. She wanted to sponge bathe me. Like, I showered last night before bed. Like, please just leave me alone. And, she was pretty persistent, but, she finally gave in, which at that point in time, I didn't know what a big deal that was. I had no idea what a big deal that was. That was a huge deal because, as soon as she passed me this robe, told me to put it on, I taken my pajamas off, taking my underwear off, taking my shoes up. She scooped up all my stuff and she got up and she walked out of the tent. And she left me sitting on this upturned bucket in the tent. I mean, it was just for a couple seconds before the man came in. But while I was sitting there, I just remember feeling like I was in complete shock. I mean, how had this happened to me? Why had this happened to me? Why had they kidnapped me? Why? There was no good reason why anyone should kidnap me. I wasn't special. I didn't stand out. I mean, I was just, like, I was a wallflower, and I was happy being a wallflower. And as I was sitting there, just like in total shock over what had happened, in came the man, and he had changed out of the dark clothing that he had worn to kidnap me in, and he put on this long tunic, this long robe kind of thing, just like the one that I'd been forced to put on. And he came in and he knelt down next to me and he started speaking. Well, I was terrified of him. When he'd broken into my home in the middle of the night, he'd held a knife at my neck. He told me to go with him. I didn't know if he'd killed the rest of my family. I didn't know what else he was capable of. I mean, I was terrified of him. And frankly, initially, I was too scared to even listen to what he was saying. And then finally my brain kicked in and said, you should probably listen, because there might be some, he might be saying something about why he decided to kidnap you, or how long he's going to hold you captive for, or if he's going to kill you, or maybe there'll be a way to get a message to your family, something. So you should probably pay attention. So I pulled myself together enough to listen to what he was saying. And I only heard the last sentence that he said, which I'm not 100% sure, but if I had to take a guess, I would say it was probably the worst sentence that he said, because it's when he told me that I was now his wife. And I remember that moment being so shocked. I remember being so just abhorred. I mean, how could someone do that? I was 14. How could he think that was okay? How could he kidnap me and then tell me that I was now his wife? I mean, of everything that could happen to me, this surely couldn't actually be happening to me. I remember in that moment just screaming out no, because he had to realize this was not okay. And I remember when I screamed out, he looked at me and he said, if you ever scream out like that again, I will kill you. If it'll help you not scream out, I can duct tape your mouth shut. Well, I knew that I didn't want to be killed, and I knew that I didn't want my mouth duct taped shut. So I told him I wouldn't scream out again, but he had to realize this was not okay. He had to realize this was not legal. There was no way that he could do this to me. And I remember every reason that I gave him, he had the same response to, which was, it's now time to consummate our marriage. Well, as I mentioned, I was incredibly shy growing up. I was very self-conscious. Wallflower, happy to be a wallflower, happy to blend in, happy to not be noticed, happy to continue living in my little bubble. And when he kept on saying, it's now time to consummate our marriage, I did not know what he meant. I didn't. And when he said that, I was like, what? What are you talking about? And I had this idea come to me of what he could possibly mean. And I remember thinking, no, there's no way that one human being could be so evil to do that to another human being. No, I cannot believe that will happen. And he kept on saying it and kept on saying it. And just also, so you get to know me a little bit better, I had only learned what sex was a couple years earlier. I mean, when I say I lived in a bubble, like I genuinely did not know a lot of things, a lot of the facts of life. And it was because my best friend who lived across the street decided to tell me. And I remember when she told me, I remember just looking at her and be like, what is wrong with you? Like, how on earth did you think that up? That is disgusting. You're disgusting. Oh, that is just revolting. Like, ew, gross, 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 gross. That's not. And I was like, that can't be sex. If that's sex, sex isn't a thing, because that is way too gross for any two humans to, you know, engage in that kind of activity. Disgusting. Yuck. And she's like, no, Elizabeth, really. Like, it's part of life. Actually, it's how babies are made. And I was like, what? No. There's no. My mom actually told me how babies are made, and I know how they're made. You know, you grow up, you fall in love, you get married, and then when you're ready to have a baby, you pray. And then God blesses you with a baby. That being said, it's kind of funny, but kind of sad at the same time. A little bit of pathetic. But because my mom told me that, sometimes I used to worry that if I prayed too hard, I'd accidentally get pregnant. I know. You can laugh. It's okay. I laugh at it now too, because it is funny. Anyway, that was me and my friend. She was like, Elizabeth, no, really. Sex, it's how babies are made. Like, it's part of life. Like, you'll probably do it one day. Your parents have already done it. And I'm like, oh, stop. That's disgusting. Stop right there. And she was like, no, really? And I was like, okay, just for the record, just to be crystal clear, you do realize that that is where the pee comes out of. Like, you want a guy, like, who pees out of his penis to stick that inside me? No way. What if he accidentally pees in me? That's disgusting. I'm not doing that. And really, my thoughts on sex since the time that I found out what it was to the time that I was kidnapped, they had not changed a whole lot. They were still pretty much the same, other than I accepted it now as that was how babies are made and it's a fact of life. And that was really as far as I accepted it. So it still to me was disgusting and gross and like had no appeal to me as a 14-year-old. And this man, he kept saying to me, you know, it's not time to consummate our marriage, it's not time to consummate our marriage. And finally, it didn't matter what I said. It didn't matter how much I begged. It didn't matter how much I cried or pleaded or anything. He forced me on the ground and he raped me. And when he was finished, he stood up and he smiled like it wasn't a big deal. And he turned around and he walked out of the tent. But for me, that was devastating. I mean, that was just world shattering to me. I mean, I grew up in a very conservative neighborhood. I grew up in a very religious community, one that put a lot of emphasis on the importance of remaining a virgin until marriage. I mean, I remember so many lessons in Sunday school talking about chastity and virtue and purity. And it all basically boiled down to the same thing, which was don't have sex before marriage. Because if you do, no one will want you. Because if you do, you will be dirty, you will be filthy. Nobody wants that. So you will be worthless. And so essentially, it was just putting value on you if you only had value if you were a virgin before marriage. And no one had ever taken the time to discuss with me what rape was. No one had ever taken the time to discuss with me what sexual violence was, or that there was in fact a difference between enthusiastic consensual sex and rape. I didn't know that there was a difference. I thought they were the same thing. So when he finished raping me, I remember just lying on the ground, not only feeling a lot of physical pain and emotional pain over everything that had just happened, but I also remember feeling a lot of spiritual pain, because how could anyone want me now? I mean, I was ruined and I was dirty and I was filthy and I was broken, and that made me garbage. And maybe it would just be better if he killed me now, so that I didn't have to continue living my life feeling like I'm not as good as everyone else, feeling like I'm not as clean or as worthy as everyone else. Suddenly I'm worthless. And I genuinely felt that way. And at that point in time, I don't honestly remember if I fell asleep or if I just passed out from everything. But the next thing that I do remember was opening my eyes, because I could feel someone wrapping something around my ankle. And I remember looking over, and there was this man, and he had a piece of metal cable, and he was wrapping it around my ankle. And then he was crushing bolts into place so that I couldn't run away. And I remember standing up to see what I was chained to, and I was chained between two trees. I had just enough length to lie down inside of the tent, and just enough length to reach the bucket that was a different bucket than I initially sat on inside the tent. This bucket was to relieve myself. And that was all. That was as far as I could move. That was it. And I remember just sitting down feeling like my life was over. What was the point of trying? What was the point of hoping, or what was the point of trying to survive? Because I wouldn't be happy. I wouldn't be accepted. I wouldn't be loved. I was damaged. I was ruined. I wasn't worthy anymore. So why would people want to have anything to do with me? And as I sat there, I remember looking around this hidden campsite, and I remember seeing all of the supplies that would have taken honestly a lot of effort to get back up to this hidden campsite. I mean, there were big trunks, like the plastic trunks, storage trunks. I didn't know what was inside them, but they looked heavy. There was like actual plates and flatware, not just like paper plates or, I mean, it was actual like breakable glass or ceramic kind of plates. And then there was actual like flatware, like stainless steel flatware. And there were cups, and they had like a little propane camping stove set up, and there were big gallon containers that had water in it. And the thought struck me that they didn't plan on just keeping me for a few hours. They didn't plan even on just keeping me for a few days. I realized that they plan on keeping me there for a long time. Well, how long is a long time? I mean, are we talking weeks? Are we talking months? Years? What if it was so long that I forgot who I was? What if it was so long that I forgot my family? And honestly, that terrified me. I never wanted to forget my family. I never wanted to forget what it felt like to be loved, because even if I was never loved again, I knew that I had been loved up until the time that he kidnapped me. So I didn't want to forget that. So I started to think of my family, and I started to think of my parents, and I just wanted to immortalize their memory so that I never, ever forgot. And I had, as I was sitting there remembering all these memories, I had one very specific memory come back to mind. I'd come home from school one day. I was very upset. My mom had asked me what was wrong. I told her how this popular girl at school had bullied me, had made me feel terrible. My mom, she tried to comfort me, and she went on, she said, you know, Elizabeth, you will meet so many people in your lifetime. And guess what? Sometimes people just won't like you. And I know it's hard and it's unfair. I mean, you can have the purest of intentions. You can have the kindest heart, and people just don't like you for whatever reason, or they might take offense over something that you said that you never meant to give offense to anyone. So the important lesson to learn here is you have to decide whose opinions actually count. You know, does this girl at school, this popular girl, does her opinion actually matter? Like, are you going to decide if to let her decide if you're happy or not? Or is that a decision you're going to make? Frankly, at that time, I hated it when she did this to me. It was all about, you know, getting back up on the horse. You know, what do you do when you fall off a horse? You get back on. Like, you don't give up. You keep trying. Like, make decisions that'll lead to your happiness. Don't wait for other people to make your happiness for you, kind of thing. Which, as an adult, I certainly appreciate. But as a kid, I was like, just feel sorry for me. Just let me feel sorry for myself. And, I mean, she would sympathize with me first. And then she'd be like, okay, come on. Time to get back up. And that's what she was doing in this moment. She went on and she said, you know, there's so many people, once again, so many opinions. This girl, her opinion really doesn't matter. And let me tell you the first few people whose opinions actually do matter. The first one is God's. His opinion matters. He'll love you, always will. The second person's opinion that actually matters, well, that would be mine. And I'm your mother. And I will always love you. I may not love everything you do. I may not always agree with all the decisions that you make, but I will always love you, and nothing can ever change that. And as I sat on this mountainside, remembering this memory, I realized that she was right. I realized that nothing could ever change the fact that she would always love me. And it didn't matter that I'd been kidnapped. It didn't matter that I'd been chained up. It didn't matter that I'd been raped. She'd still love me. She'd still want me back. And when I realized I had that, I realized I had something worth surviving for. So I made the most important decision I could have during my entire captivity. I decided I would do whatever it took to survive. Did not matter what it was. If it meant that I would live another day, then I would do it. And that's how I survived the next 9 months. They were the hardest, longest months of my life. But I survived it. And looking back, I don't regret a single decision that I made, because ultimately I'm still here today. And had I made a different decision while I was kidnapped, I don't know if I would be. I don't know if I would still be here. I have been questioned so many times about, well, you were brought out in public. Why didn't you run? Why didn't you scream? Or, you know, there was law enforcement that like approached your captors, you know, before you were rescued. Why didn't you say something? Like, you had opportunities to get away and you didn't do it. Why? And for years, whenever I was asked that question, I would immediately feel defensive. I would immediately feel personally attacked. I would immediately feel like, well, what gives them the right to question my actions? I am alive. I am here. And if you think that I was on vacation for 9 months, you're crazy. I wouldn't wish what I went through on my worst enemy. But the truth is that most people, they will never know what I went through. They will never understand it because they're not me. And the same thing applies to each one of us. You know, when we have our trials, when we have our experiences, there may be people who question us why we acted a certain way or why we didn't act a certain way. And to you, it might make perfect sense because you know the whole story. You know what led up to that moment. You know what happened after. You know what consequences are. And that person doesn't, because they're not you. And so when I'd be questioned, you know, I'd just be like, why would you ask such a question? Of course I wanted to escape. I tried to escape and it never worked out. In fact, it always made things worse for me because I never was successful. And for 9 months, I was told every day that if I ever did anything they didn't want me to do, that they would kill me. And if they didn't kill me, they would kill my family. And I had to protect myself. And as a, I felt like I had to protect my family. Of course, as an adult, I can look back and be like, well, Elizabeth, you weren't responsible for your family. You were a child. You weren't an adult. You weren't the parent. You were not responsible for protecting them. But I didn't understand that as a kid. I just knew that these two people, my two captors, were dangerous and that they posed a very real threat. And I could not risk them killing my family, because if they killed my family, what was the point of surviving? What was the point of trying to escape them if my family wasn't there to love me? Because certainly nobody else possibly could. That's genuinely how I felt. And during the 9 months that I was held captive, you know, I wasn't immediately brought out into public. I mean, it was months before I was brought out into public. And during the months prior, and even during, my captor, he would go down into Salt Lake. He'd leave me with the woman, with my female captor. And he'd go down into Salt Lake and he'd be gone all day. And then he'd finally come back and be late at night. And he usually would bring some kind of newspaper with him or some kind of missing poster. And it was always about me. It was a missing poster of my face, or it was an article in the newspaper about the search for me and the mysterious circumstances that I disappeared under, or maybe how my family was being questioned or what, or they were being investigated. And he used to laugh about it and he'd say, the whole world is looking for you, but no one will ever find you because I have you and I can do whatever I want to you and no one will stop me. And it seemed like he was right. I mean, I remember hearing helicopters and airplanes flying so low overhead that not only the trees around us shook, but the tent that I was held captive in shook. I remember even one time hearing my name being yelled. And I remember wanting so badly to yell out, to scream back. But my captor, in that moment, I remember he pulled out a knife and he held it against me. And he said, if you scream out, I will kill you. And I will kill anyone else who comes into this camp. And if I have to do that, their blood will be on your hands. And I mean, I was a sensitive kid. I mean, I think I'm still probably a pretty sensitive person. And I didn't think I could live with myself knowing that I had brought on someone's death. And so I didn't scream out. And when he'd show me these newspaper articles and he'd just tell me how he had complete control, it felt like he really did. And no one was ever there to stop him from hurting me. Anytime he said he was going to do something to me, anytime that he threatened me with anything, no one was there to protect me from him. He always, always followed through. It made me feel like he was invincible. So when he made these threats against my life and against my family's life, they were very real threats, which is why when I was finally brought out into public, and it wasn't a lot, but when I finally was brought out into public, I didn't scream out and I didn't run, because I felt like I had to do everything I could, not only for my own survival, but for the survival of my family. And that's why I didn't run. And that's why I didn't yell. And I think actually that answer would probably be very common among other victims and survivors, not even just of kidnapping, but I'd venture to say human trafficking. I'd venture to say domestic violence. I'd venture to say it's probably pretty common. It's just not openly talked about or openly understood. It's not that people enjoy being hurt. No one ever wakes up thinking, oh, today it feels like a great day to be raped. Today it feels like a great day to be hurt. Nobody wakes up like that. Nobody wants that. And I certainly didn't want that. But 9 months is a long time to be hurt. 9 months is a long time to be threatened. So it wasn't until 9 months later, and after my captors had taken me to Southern California for the winter, because frankly, we would not have survived in Northern Utah for the winter. And I had been able to convince them to return to Utah. that we made it back to Utah. We were walking up State Street in Salt Lake City, which is a very busy street. It's a very large street. And all of a sudden a police car pulled up, and then another police car. And pretty soon it felt like we were surrounded by police cars. And I remember the officers jumping out, and they came running over, and they started questioning my captors. And I mean, I was in disguise. It wasn't like I didn't look like this, you know, my hair was covered. My head was covered. I had sunglasses on. I was in strange clothes. And I started questioning my captors. And I had a captor on either side of me that was, both of them were standing so close that they were physically touching me. And even when the officer started to question me, with my captor standing right next to me, I didn't immediately answer them, because I didn't know what these officers were capable of. I didn't know if they were capable of protecting me, but I did know what my captors were capable of, and they were absolutely capable of hurting me, and they were capable of killing me. So I didn't immediately answer. And then one of the officers said, well, we need to question each of you by yourselves, and we're going to start with her. So they separated me from my captors. And then they started to question me again. And this time, one of the officers said, you know, there's a girl, and she's been missing now for a very long time. And her family has never given up hope for her. They've never stopped searching for her. They've never stopped loving her. They want her to come home more than anything in this world. Aren't you ready to come home? Don't you want to come home? And it was really only in that moment that I was finally able to admit who I was. And I remember, I mean, that day was a lot. I was actually handcuffed initially and taken to the police station, where I was thinking, oh crap, I should not have told them who I was, because now they think that I did something wrong. So I'm going to get in trouble for it. I should have just kept my mouth shut. I shouldn't have said anything. If they thought I was innocent, they must think I'm lying, because if they thought I was innocent, surely they would have taken me home. Surely they would have taken me back to my family. There's just, I can't believe this is happening to me. And then my captors, well, no, my captors, they were also handcuffed, and they were put in separate police cars. But as I was sitting there thinking about everything, I was like, I can't believe it. I'm going to go to jail. Well, okay, if I go to jail, at least I'll have a cot to sleep on. And maybe I won't get a shower every day, but once a week, it's certainly better than not never in 9 months. And they can't let me starve, so that means I'll probably have food, you know, at least one meal a day. Okay, you know, that sounds like a pretty good deal. Like, that's better than where I've been the last 9 months. So really, the situation, it can't get worse. It really can only get better. And I genuinely thought that. And it wasn't until I'd been at the police station for a little while, I'd been unhandcuffed, and all of a sudden, the door to the little room that I was in just burst open, and my dad came running into the room. It was like he appeared out of nowhere. He ran up to me and he hugged me and he started crying. And it was only in that moment that I finally felt like I was safe again, that I felt like it didn't matter what the future held. It didn't matter what, it didn't matter what happened next, because everything was going to be okay. My dad was there. He was never going to let another person hurt me the way that these two people had hurt me the last 9 months. And I remember getting home that evening and feeling like a princess, feeling like I was so lucky, feeling like everything that had been taken away from me had been given back. And I didn't want to miss out on anything that my future held. I wanted to make up for lost time. I wanted to live my absolute fullest life. And I remember the next morning, my mom, she stopped me and she said, Elizabeth, what these people have done to you is terrible. And there aren't words strong enough to describe how wicked and evil they are. They've stolen 9 months of your life from you that you will never get back. The best punishment you could ever give them is to be happy, is to live your life, to do all the things that you want to do. Because by feeling sorry for yourself, that's only allowing them to steal more of your life away from you. And they don't deserve that. They don't deserve a single second more. So you need to be happy and you need to live your life to the very fullest. And as I've spent a lot of time thinking about what she told me that day, I think she's absolutely right. I think that advice alone impacted me more than maybe any other single piece of advice ever has. And I wish it was easy as just, you know, making a decision and being like, okay, now the past is done and over with. I'm not going to let it hurt me anymore. I don't think it's quite that easy. And I think my mom knew that. I think she knew that I would experience the whole range of emotion. I mean, I think she knew I'd deal with anger and frustration and grief and pain. I think she knew that I would deal with that, but I think she wanted me to remember to never give up on happiness, to never give up on reaching for it, on holding on to that belief that it is possible for me to be happy again. Even if I don't feel it right this second, it is real and I can have it in my life, and continually to work towards that each day. And I don't feel like life is a straight line. I mean, I just don't think so. I think we have, you know, loops and ups and downs and backwards and forwards, and probably looks like a big, huge scribble, to be honest. But I also believe that we are absolutely capable of happiness. We are absolutely capable of peace and of joy and of finding meaning in life, even after the very worst of experiences have happened to us. And alongside that belief, I don't think that we do ourselves any favors by comparing ourselves to anyone else, by thinking, well, you know, I was only raped once and she was raped every day. Like, I should be over this. I should be fine. She seems like she's fine and she was hurt for so much longer than me and I'm not fine. That doesn't do anyone any favors. So please do not do that, because at the end of the day, pain is still pain. And if you're hurting, belittling it and trying to compare it to someone else's is not going to help you deal with it. So please do not do that. Please believe in yourself. Please believe that we all have our struggles. And I mean, social media is a perfect example of that. I mean, how many people do we see who seem to have their lives together all the time? I mean, I remember last Thanksgiving, it literally looked like a bomb went off in my house. I mean, there were pots and pans on every surface in my home. I mean, there was crumbs everywhere. There was food everywhere. And then there's stuff everywhere. And I was exhausted by the end of the day. And I got on social media. I got on Instagram, the way that I'm sure many of us do. And I was just scrolling through to look at other people's. And I remember seeing this one woman's house. And she was like, oh, so excited for Thanksgiving dinner. And honestly, she had this beautiful, it looks like a marble table. Like, the whole table looks like a piece of marble. And it was beautifully set. And house looked so pristine and so clean, and I was just like, oh, how does she do it? I tried so hard. How does she do it? And I looked over at my husband and I was like, Matthew, why? I tried so hard. And he's like, Elizabeth, just because this is on Instagram doesn't mean it's real. I mean, for all I know, she probably totally does have it together, and that probably was her Thanksgiving. But my husband brings up a great point. So many of us only show on social media what we want to show, how we want to portray our best lives, our best moments. I mean, I know I've been guilty of looking at my pictures and being like, oh, that's a funny angle, let's take the picture again. Or, yeah, I don't love that picture, I'm not going to post it. I mean, there are also those times where I'm like, I don't care anymore. Like, I'm not perfect. I'm just going to show my imperfect self. That does also happen to me plenty. But, you know, a lot of times we don't know what my point is that we don't know what's going on under the surface. We don't know. We don't know what their struggles are. We don't know what they deal with. And so you should never compare yourself to anyone. And kind of going back to what I said at the beginning, no matter what it is you've gone through, you are so much more resilient than you think you are. You have so much more strength than you think you are. And just because you're struggling does not mean you're weak. Just because you need to ask for help, that doesn't mean you're weak. That means you're strong. That means you're strong enough to realize that this will be easier, or that you'll have more tools available to you if you do ask for help, because those people who are out there to help you are out there, and we should absolutely make use of them. I mean, if something's going to make this life better, then let's do it. Please know that no matter what you've been through, it doesn't take away from your worth as a human being. It doesn't make you any less worthy. It doesn't make you any less valuable. You were born with that value. You will always have that value. And just because something bad has happened to you, it doesn't define who you are. It doesn't make you you. Yes, it might absolutely alter your direction in life. I mean, my goodness, I probably would not be here speaking to you today had I not been kidnapped. But it doesn't define who you are. You define who you are through the decisions and the choices that you make. That's ultimately how you define who you are. Now, I know I've been going on for a long time now, and there are some questions that are being asked. So the first question that's come through to me is, how has this experience impacted your parenting style? Well, that is a great question. When my daughter was born, my oldest daughter, I have three children now. My oldest is 6, and then I have a 4-year-old boy, and I have a 2-year-old girl. And when my oldest was born, I remember feeling like my heart moved from my chest up until my throat, and I don't feel like it's ever gone back down to my chest. It's definitely made me feel like I have to know where they're at all the time. I want to be involved in every little part of their life. I mean, probably to an annoying extent. I mean, my daughter, she's in first grade and she loves it. And I'm so happy she loves it. And she's making all these friends, and she wants to have play dates with them. And she's always like, you can leave, Mom. You don't have to stay and watch us. But until I know the other family that she's around, I don't just let her go by herself. I don't just, you know, drop her off and say, see you in 2 hours. I mean, I'm usually like, okay, well, let's meet at the park for like the first 5 times where I can chat and get to know you. And then it's okay. Then maybe she can have her friend come here. Or if I had lots of time to get to know the mom, then maybe it's okay. I can let her go there. It's also made me feel like I need to be very proactive. At the end of last year, her kindergarten year, I remember I felt like I had lots of good conversations with her about safety. And it was towards the end of the year, and it had been, I don't know, like a few weeks, or maybe it had been a month since I had had this conversation with her. But I asked her, I said, what do you do if someone starts hurting you or starts touching you? Like, what do you do if they touch your bottom, or they start touching your chest, or they start touching you where your underwear cover? What do you do? And she's like, well, I go tell my teacher. And I was like, okay. I was like, that's a great thing. I was like, what if your teacher's not around? And she's like, well, then I tell my teacher when I see my teacher. And I was like, well, do you think maybe it's okay if you yell? Or do you think maybe it's okay if you bite this person or scratch this person or kick them? And at first she kind of giggled, and she's like, oh, Mama. She's like, I couldn't do that. Then I'd lose a star next to my name. And I was like, my darling child. If anyone ever touches you, you know, where your swimsuit covers you, if anyone ever tries to hurt you, if anyone ever tries to take you, I want you to do anything and everything you can to protect yourself. So if that means biting someone, I want you to bite them. If that means hitting someone, I want you to hit them. If it means yelling, doing everything, then that's what I want you to do. And she's like, but mama, what if I lose a star next to my name? And I was like, honey, I will go talk to your teacher. I will go talk to your principal. If you're still in trouble, we'll go to Hawaii. Like, I will be on your side, honey. Like, I will be there for you. I will go talk to whoever I have to talk to, because I want you to always protect yourself. And if you ever see anyone else doing that to anyone else, I want you to tell us, I want you to tell me, I want you to tell your teacher, I want you to tell whatever adults around. So we have, sorry, I get very emotional about these things. I get very passionate about these things. We've had a lot of conversations. I'm trying to talk to her currently about the difference between a secret and a surprise. A surprise is okay. A secret is bad. She does, like, it's a work in progress. I think there's still some confusion on the differentiating between the two. And with my little boy, you know, I'm trying to have the same conversations with him. And actually, someone told me that I think is actually pretty great advice, is that when your children start asking questions, that's when you need to start talking. And frankly, I was shocked when my daughter, when my oldest started asking questions, because I didn't anticipate it. She was like 3 years old. I was like, what? Why are you asking me these questions? But that being said, I started talking to her about it, and it was not at an advanced, it wasn't at a high or a graphic or a detailed level. But even as a three-year-old, I began talking to them, and I'm not perfect. I'm still trying to figure it out. I mean, if only there was like the perfect parenting manual. I don't think that exists though. So I'm still just, you know, trying to work my way through it and figure it out. The comment, we all do that now with our children. Keep it up. When she is a teen, it will get worse. Oh, well, thank you. Everything I wanted to hear, but I'm sure you're probably right. She's already asked me for a cell phone. And I'm like, you're six. You're never getting a phone. Well, not even a cell phone. I think when I say cell phone, I think just phone. But I think when she says phone, she means a smartphone. And I'm like, no way. No way. So I'm glad to know I'm not the only person who, you know, has these conversations, but also is just trying to do the best they can. I suppose that's all any of us can do. I mean, so that those are two, one question, one comment. I guess I'll just keep talking with you until another question comes through. I think, you know, I did this podcast recently, and it was with this woman. Now, oh, for goodness sakes, this is incredibly embarrassing. She's very well known. She's very well respected. I'm going to blame it on not being fully awake this morning. I am very awake, but I wrote her name down and I can't remember it. But she, like, her podcast is used as a resource in the Library of Congress on human trafficking. Anyway, she's a very well respected woman. And when we were having this back and forth conversation, you know, she had asked me sort of similar questions about parenting. She's like, well, what do you tell your kids? And so I told her what I said, and she's like, well, you know, like, what are other ways, or how else do you, like, work with your kids to help them understand their boundaries, or how do you teach them their boundaries? How do you respect their boundaries? And I was like, well, frankly, I was like, I'm still pretty new to parenting. You know, I'm not an expert on this. I was like, well, maybe you have some insight that you could share with me that would help. And so she's like, well, actually, yeah, I do. She was like, you know, children are so beautiful and they are so precious and they're so pure. And we are always, you know, we want to protect that. And, you know, when we see family come over, we're always like, oh, you know, they're so adorable. Or why don't you go give your uncle a hug? Or why don't you, you know, go kiss your grandparents? Or, you know, go give, you know, this is my best friend. Go give them a hug. You know, we tell our children, like, go hug this person or go hug that person. And sometimes they don't want to. And you're like, oh, come on, just give them a hug. It's fine. Go do it. And she's like, when we do that, that is not respecting their boundaries. If they don't want to hug someone, as parents, we should respect that boundary. That reinforces to them that we respect them and that they have the right to choose who they hug, which as they grow up also continues to grow and expand. It's something as small as respecting our children's right to decide who they hug and who they don't hug, you know, when they're very small. And that advice, I think, is great advice. I think she makes a brilliant point in that, you know, there are boundaries that we should respect now, even while our children are so little, or while my children are so little. I think that is amazing, and great advice. So here's another question. Can you please tell Elizabeth that her story really touched me spiritually and emotionally and helped me? I admire her very much. My question is, how does she work through not letting trauma define her so that she can achieve her dreams? So, and it looks like there's other questions kind of along those same lines, you know, about therapy, what is helpful, what kind, things that I've done. So, great question. I 100% believe in therapy. I think there are so many different modalities of therapy. I think we have so many options, and frankly, there's just not enough education around the different kinds of options and kinds of therapies that are out there. But initially, when I got back, I was brought to a children's advocacy center, and I was told, I mean, I didn't fully understand what was going on in the situation, but I was just told that I had to go in and I had to speak to these two psychiatrists. And so I did. But I remember walking in there, and they were two men. They were, you know, middle age. They were both clearly religious, and immediately just seeing that, I immediately did not want to talk to them. I mean, I'd been kidnapped by an older middle-aged man. He had used religion to manipulate me, to justify all the different kinds of abuse that he victimized me with. And so being alone in that situation with these two male psychiatrists, who were both clearly religious, that was just something that was very much outside my comfort zone. It was already going to be hard enough to talk about what happened, but to do it with these two men made it infinitely more difficult to talk about. And so at the time I didn't fully understand why I had to talk to them. I didn't realize that I was talking to them because they were supposedly going to stand as proxy for me during the trial. In my mind, I just knew that they were psychiatrists, so I immediately thought this was therapy, and it ended up being actually really traumatic. I mean, I was a little girl, honestly. Like, even when I was 15 and I experienced a lot, like, I was still a little girl, and that was very, very traumatizing. So not fully understanding why I was there, what it was, I thought that that was therapy. And I was like, I never want to do that again. And I thought that was just going to be more like, maybe if I went to someone else, it would be that same thing again. And I was like, no, I do not. I do not want to go through that again. And I think when I told my parents that, they panicked, because they wanted me to, you know, heal. They wanted me to be happy. They wanted me to have my best life. And so they were so worried and panicked when I said that I didn't want to go to therapy, that they went to therapy and they found a counselor, and that counselor help them. And they later told me that what helped them was that the therapist was like, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay that she doesn't want to go right now. Because at the end of the day, whether she decides to go see a counselor or a therapist or not, ultimately you two are her parents and you are going to be her biggest therapist that she has during this time in her life. So you need to make sure that you are in a place to be available for her. So if she needs to talk about something, you can't let your emotions get in the way of helping her and helping her process them. So they actually went to therapy quite a bit. Well, I didn't. But I felt like I was able to find healing and therapy in different ways. I feel like I felt it and experienced it through music. Whatever I couldn't articulate through words, I felt like I could articulate through music. I felt like, my grandpa, who was one of the few men, the few males that I trusted after I was rescued, he used to take me out horseback riding up in the mountains with him. And I always felt safe with him. And I don't 100% know if I can articulate or explain why it helped me so much, but I felt like riding horses was so cathartic and powerful for me. I mean, I feel like I can look at it from a couple of different angles. On one hand, it's this huge, 1,000-pound animal or more that I'm riding, that I am controlling with two little pieces of leather and a little bit of metal in between. And I mean, if this horse wanted to run off, if this horse wanted to not respond to, my commands with the reins, it could. And yet this horse trusts me enough to guide it the direction that I want it to go in. This horse trusts me enough to allow me to ride on his back. I think that was a pretty empowering feeling, that this horse didn't care anything about my past or what had happened to me. All it cared about was the here and the now and the connection that we shared while we were on this ride. The other side of that I think was pretty helpful in healing for me was when my grandpa would take me out horseback riding. It was almost like I was being taken out of, reality for just a little while, a couple hours. And, we'd go out riding, we'd be in like this beautiful place in nature. And it was just almost like, it gave me this perspective of, hey, like, this is just a moment in life. Like, your life is more than 9 months. Your life is more than, 15, 16, 17 years, however old I was at that time. And your life is going to keep going. Don't give up. Keep trying. So that was helpful. I mean, honestly, I have since seen a therapist. I have since seen counselors, but it was actually related to when my parents got a divorce a few years ago. And it was very helpful. And I think that had a proper understanding of what therapy really was, I absolutely think it would have been helpful and impactful to me after I'd been rescued. But I just didn't have that understanding. I didn't have that knowledge at the time. And I was stubborn. And I mean, my husband would tell you that I still am stubborn, but that was how it ended up happening. And ultimately, I do believe that I'm in a great place. I'm in a happy place. I have a beautiful life. I have a beautiful family. I'm human. Like, I still have bad days. I have great days. I have bad days. I have in between days. But I am happy in my life. And so I'm very blessed for that. I'm very grateful for that. Another question is faith and religion still a strong component of your life for you and for your children/family? That is a great question as well. Yes, I think, I mean, faith, belief in God has always been a huge source of comfort to me, has always been important to me. I mean, like, as far back as I can remember, I've always believed in God. As I've gotten older, I still believe in God. There are things that I, you know, grew up with that I thought I would always believe that I no longer believe or that I disagree with, but I still having a relationship with God and belief in Him is very, very important to me. It's very important to my family. I mean, I want my children to always know that no matter what they go through, there is someone out there who understands exactly what they're going through. And I think that is such a comfort to have, no matter what you're going through. Decide not to, that's their decision. I at least want to give them that foundation, and they choose it later in their life to turn away from it and walk away from it. That's their choice, and that's okay. But for me, I feel like it has been helpful, and it's an important part of my life. Yes. Another question is, have your parents ever experienced any sense of guilt over what you have experienced, particularly the night of your kidnapping? That is, I actually wondered that. I wondered that because there had been a kitchen window that had been left cracked open. That was how my captor, you know, broke into my house, was through that kitchen window. And you know, it was my parents' house. It was on my parents' watch. And so I actually did ask them, I was like, have you ever felt guilty about, you know, leaving the window open or, you know, not stopping what happened to me from happening? And, both of them actually said no. I mean, my mom, when I asked her more about it, she was like, Elizabeth, if I blamed myself for what happened to you, I couldn't live. I couldn't live life. And at the end of the day, I did everything I could to get you back. I never wanted you to be kidnapped. You know, I never wanted you to be raped. I never wanted you to experience any of those things that you experienced. These were all decisions made by a very evil man and his evil wife. They are the ones who are at fault. They were the ones that trespassed. They were the ones that broke into our home. They are the ones that kidnapped you. They are the ones that did everything else to you. So no, they are the ones who are at fault. And I think initially I was actually kind of surprised that they didn't feel some sense of guilt, but I'm actually really happy that they don't, because I wouldn't want them to be living their life feeling constant guilt. So, I mean, I kind of feel like that makes them heroic in their own way. And then last question. How do you stop from projecting your fears of your experience onto your own children? Well, that is a good, great question. My husband is he's a very good counterpart to me. He is very good at balancing me out. So when I get too extreme, he usually pulls me back. And so I just have to believe in our marriage that if I am projecting too much on them, that he will pull me back. And so our parenting style, I feel like, is very much an act of teamwork. And I have to trust that he'll rein me in when I go crazy. So with that being said, thank you so much for staying with me this session. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you all, and God bless.